I remember when I first got involved in the movement nearly 20 years ago, one of the first books I read was Naga Bodhi's book, Jai Bhim, which, it, as you probably know, is a book about the Dharma revolution in India. That's what it's mainly about. But in the book, Naga Bodhi also talks about himself getting involved in the movement in the 70s. And he talks a bit about being around the LBC Mandala in the 1970s. And one little story he tells in the book, which has always stuck in my mind for some reason, is a story of him getting the job of showing round the LBC Mandala a guy who's come to make a film. And this filmmaker is actually a well-known communist. And he's making a documentary about different cooperatives in the cooperative movement of the 1970s. And he's come to the LBC to film them and to find out about them as a cooperative. So Naga Bodhi shows him round. He shows him the centre. He shows him the communities. And he shows him the cooperative businesses. And of course, they're all run on the basis of give what you can, take what you need. They're all forming teams, making decisions on the basis of consensus. And they're all, yeah, formed of really idealistic young people who are just working really, really hard trying to build something because they think the Dharma can change the world. And apparently at the end of the visit, this communist filmmaker, said to Naga Bodhi that he thought the LBC was the most ideologically pure example of a co-op that he'd seen. That was his parting comment. So I've been wondering recently, what would a Marxist say if they walked around the LBC today? Or around any of our other Buddhist centres? What would people's impressions of us be in terms of how radical we are? Do we still believe in the ability of the Dharma to transform self and society? Do we still want to make a distinctive dharmic contribution to building a better world, economically, socially, culturally? Are we willing to accept that challenge ourselves? And are we willing sometimes to challenge the views and values of our society? So as part of kind of reflecting on that and investigating that, I did a little experiment. I looked recently, just a few weeks ago, at our websites. So I looked at 22 websites of UK urban Buddhist centres. And I didn't look at all the whole website in each case. I looked at the homepage, the page which gave details of introductory events, and the page that explained about meditation and the page that explained about Buddhism. Yeah, so I just selected those particular pages of our websites. And so what I was doing was I was looking at the pages that I thought people coming along to us, people new to our movement, would go to first. And of course the web these days is the way most people get their information. So I was looking at what I thought most people would see about us first. And I was asking, okay, what are we communicating to those people through those web pages? And I explored four things in particular. So first thing I looked at was, what were we offering to people coming along to us? Were we offering meditation or Buddhism or some combination of them? And typically what we were offering was a centre would have a few or several Buddhism and meditation courses running through the year. They would be going on. But there'd also be drop-in meditation classes, meditation days, and meditation courses. So it was very apparent that meditation was much more prominent, was much more to the fore. I actually counted it up, and there was at least 2.5 times more opportunity to do a meditation class than there was to do a Buddhism and meditation class. And I only noticed one course where you could go straight in and just do Buddhism from day one, as it were. So meditation was much, much more strongly to the fore. More than that, even when centres were running Buddhism and meditation courses, a typical blurb for such a course would be something like, you can come along and learn two meditation practices, and then the second half will introduce some basic principles of meditation. So even there, I felt in a kind of subtle way, it was meditation which again was at the front, and the Buddhism kind of came second somehow, in a kind of subtle way. That was what was being communicated. So yeah, meditation was much more kind of prime, much more to the fore. And I wondered about that. I mean, I used to do a lot of teaching at the Birmingham Buddhist Centre over many years. And definitely quite some years ago, there was a time when people came along, most people did come along because they were interested in meditation. And they were a little bit wary about Buddhism. They were a bit suspicious of Buddhism. But I remember a time quite some years ago when that changed. And my experience teaching at Birmingham was that just as many, if not more, people were interested in Buddhism as meditation. And they were certainly interested in it, and open and curious and kind of willing to find out about Buddhism. So I wondered whether we'd got the balance right. And I wondered whether the way we had things meant that we were likely to attract, or more likely to attract, certain kinds of people, and not be so good at attracting certain other kinds of people. I wondered, well, who are we really catering for here? And who is it that we really want to cater for in the main, as it were? And I remembered, as I was thinking about this, Dana Priya in Deal. He went there a couple of years ago or something, and what he did was he gave public talks on Buddhism. And sometimes at his talks there were 60 or 70 people coming along to hear a talk on Buddhism. So I just wondered, was there much more opportunity to have Buddhism rather than meditation much more upfront and to the fore? So that was the first thing I investigated. Second thing was I looked at the words and the language that we were using to talk about Buddhism and meditation. So I went to all those pages, what is Buddhism, what is meditation, I cut and pasted them into a Word document. And I did word counts on the adjectives that were used to describe Buddhism and meditation. And it was very interesting. The most common words were words like aware or mindful, perhaps no surprise. Then came calm and karma. Joint third was wise or kind. Fourth was open or accepting or tolerant. Positive, compassion, and so on. Yeah. So these are good words. There's nothing wrong with those words, and they definitely describe something about meditation and Buddhism. But again, I wondered whether they were rather one-sided. I wondered whether they were very much about presenting Buddhism and meditation about our inner personal life, about being calm, gentle, and peaceful, and so on. I wondered whether they were very much going along with the current zeitgeist about what Buddhism is that's out there in the wider society. And I noticed that there were certain other words that just didn't get mentioned at all. So the word courageous, selfless, resilient, fearless, even the word confident. Those words just weren't there in the way that we were talking about Buddhism and meditation. Third thing I looked at was the images, the visual images that were being used. So there were 31 Buddha images or Buddhist icons on these pages that I looked at. So again, that's quite appropriate, nothing wrong with that. They were mainly peaceful meditating Buddhas. Yeah. The next biggest set of images was flowers, candles, and quite soft nature images. Yeah, so that was the next biggest set of images. Then came pictures of the building of the Buddhist Centre and pictures of people in groups talking or meditating and so on. So again, nothing wrong with those kinds of images, but I thought, what's that really saying about us? Is there the right balance there? All the images seemed, yeah, quite peaceful, quite soft. They were about, well, this is an oasis, this place is a kind of peaceful calm oasis that you can come to. And I wondered whether that was the whole story, and I wondered whether that was really the message that we wanted to be given. In all the pages that I looked at, there were only two images that jumped out at me as being more dynamic. One was on the site of the Manchester Buddhist Centre. It was on their homepage, and it was a picture of a woman meditating. So first of all, it was just kind of what I was expecting. It's a woman meditating. But then you noticed she's actually sitting in the middle of a town square with people kind of walking, you know, shoppers and people walking past her, hurrying past her, as it were. So I thought that was a really good image, a really strong image, because it's, first of all, it kind of shows you, oh yeah, meditation, it's kind of something that people can relate to and they're kind of expecting. But then it kind of stretched people's assumptions, it kind of stretched people's expectations about what was going on. It was kind of questioning, maybe in a subtle, clever way, what meditation was really about. So I thought that was a good image, a bit more dynamic. And the second dynamic image I saw was on the site of the West London Buddhist Centre. And this was a picture of a kid on a skateboard. He was going down to a slope and he was just about to come to a drop. Yeah. So I thought, what's that about? What's that doing on the West London Buddhist Centre site? So I asked the guy I live with, who's of a younger generation than me, and he said, well, when skateboarders do that, it's called a drop-in. So I went back to the site, and sure enough, it was advertising a drop-in meditation class. So there you go. At least that was a bit more dynamic, as it were. So yeah, those images was the third thing I explored. The fourth thing I explored was, how many times was the idea of the Dharma transforming the world mentioned in our little blurbs about Buddhism on our websites? And this, I must say, is the one that really shocked me. It was only mentioned 3 times in 22 websites. 3 times in 22 websites. And even then, it would typically be just kind of one clause in a sentence. You know, Buddhism is blah, 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 and we, you know, aim to contribute to making a better world. Yeah. It was just a kind of quick mention. So in other words, the idea of the Dharma transforming society, it really wasn't there. It really wasn't present at all strongly in the way that we communicate, in the way that we talk about ourselves to the general public. And yeah, in some ways I was quite shocked by the extent of that. So in the next section of my talk, I just want to explore why that might be a bit more. What might kind of hold us back from being a bit more bold, a bit more radical? What are the challenges for us collectively in how we present the Dharma today, today's world? When I was reflecting on this, the shape my reflections took was the first three of the 10 fetters. Yeah. So just my kind of reflections kind of fell into that pattern. So as you know, that the first three fetters are, firstly, fixed self-view. So just having a kind of fixed view of oneself or other people or something. Yeah, just a kind of getting kind of stuck in a rut or habit, as Bhante's rendered it. The second one is doubt. So not a kind of honest questioning things, but a kind of holding back, a hesitant, uncertain, vague kind of doubt, which is basically due to lack of integration, that we've got part of us which wants to go that way, but other parts of us want to go other ways, and so we're kind of stuck where we are, in a kind of state of doubt. And then the third fetter is rites and rituals as ends in themselves. So this is when we go through the motions of something, maybe even doing the right thing, but we're just kind of going through the motions. It's not really connected to the underlying purpose or meaning. And so Bhante sometimes renders this as superficiality. So yeah, it was these three fetters that my reflections kind of went into, as it were. So I'm going to start with the fetter of superficiality. And yeah, I just want to talk a little bit about how the image of Buddhism in the wider society is not of our making. Yeah. If you went onto the streets in Norwich or London or somewhere and asked people what they thought Buddhism was about, what would they say? Well, actually, I think a lot of what they'd say would be very positive. Yeah. I think Buddhism has got a good press at the moment. So I think in many ways they'd have a positive image, but I suspect they'd have also a rather limited ideal or image of what Buddhism is about. And of course it's an image which is made partly through the media, partly through advertising and so on. It's not an image which is made by Buddhists necessarily or completely by any extent. So probably a lot of people think about Buddhism as being calm. It's about accepting things. It's about learning to deal with stress. It's about learning to switch off. That kind of thing. Yeah. So if that's the image that's out there in the wider society, those might be the kind of people that we attract. Yeah. The people who are kind of that appeals to. They turn up at our centres, and then in a way it's quite understandable to try and cater for those kind of people when they turn up at a class. We try quite rightly to make the Dharma accessible to them, to make what we're teaching accessible to them. And then, of course, that means teaching the class a certain way, which means it's likely that we just go on attracting those kinds of people, and maybe only those kinds of people, and not other kinds of people who might be into something more challenging or different in some way. So this is the question that I'm asking. Have we kind of got in to presenting the Dharma in a certain way, a certain form, which might attract some people but not others, and maybe isn't attracting those who want something more immediately challenging and radical? It's just so easy to kind of get used to what we're doing and to get a bit glib and superficial about it. I know what this is like. I've written so many blurbs in my time. I've written so many website texts. And sometimes you do it in a hurry and you end up just cut and pasting from the last one you did, and you don't stop and think, what is it I'm really trying to communicate here? What is it that I really want to say to people? Yeah? You just go on to kind of autopilot and produce the same old thing as last time. And I think the danger is, if you do that, is that you kind of just start to take on what's around you in the culture. You just start to kind of accommodate to that kind of sense of what the Dharma is or what Buddhism and meditation is about. You go into a kind of default mode. And I think that is the fetter of superficiality. So you can't ignore the image of Buddhism in the wider society. You do have to speak to it to some extent. You can't speak a completely different language, but nor do you over-accommodate to those ideas and images. You kind of speak to them, and then you kind of stretch them and kind of move them along in some kind of way. And I just wanted to say here as a bit of a qualifier that I don't think we really are superficial in our own practice. That's not what I'm saying. I think the order members who are doing classes at all those centres are doing it because they want to contribute something to the world, because they think the Dharma does have something to contribute to the world. But I'm just saying that that could come across much more strongly, much more boldly. I think we forget how radical we are. A year or so ago, I was on a weekend of young people, and the question was asked, what does it mean to be radical? And it was very interesting what their answer was. They said, well, the five precepts are radical. Going on retreat, that's radical. The Bodhisattva ideal, that's really radical. Yeah. And we can forget. We can get so familiar with these kind of basic things that we get over familiar with them. And we forget. We've heard them so often. We've taught them so often. We forget just how radical they are, just what an impact they can make to people who are new to them. So it's a practice to kind of keep them fresh and to keep presenting them in that fresh way. And this made me think that maybe our website blurbs, well, we should get those people to write them for us. Yeah? We should just find someone in our Sangha who's fairly new to things and who, you know, you can see that the Dharma and meditation has had a really strong impact on them, and ask them, say, well, can you write can you explain what effect it's had on you and put that on the website? And that would be just much more fresh and probably much more bold and radical. So I think that we need to have a good look actually at how we present ourselves. And I'm not just talking about adding in a few sentences about the social implications of Buddhism to an otherwise unchanged website. I think it's something a bit more than that that's needed. So rather than the Dharma's transforming self and world, rather than that idea being something that you might bump up against if you come along to classes for long enough, I'd like it up there right at the front, that's kind of what's on the home page, as it were, that some way that idea is presented to people. And that all the other things that we do are framed in that context. So again, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying don't do a drop-in meditation class for people who are stressed. That might be a really good thing to do. But I'm just saying it's a question of balance, and it's a question of the kind of overarching vision and message and context in which all those other things are placed and communicated. So maybe we could have courses on Buddhism and transforming the world. Maybe we could be doing much more to give public Dharma talks where we link Buddhism to contemporary issues. Maybe we need to stay alert to opportunities and have the courage to seize the moment when they occur. So the kind of thing I mean was, I remember when I was at Birmingham Buddhist Centre when 9/11 happened. And I clearly remember in the few weeks after that happened, more people came to our introductory classes. The numbers went up. Yeah. And I remember regretting that I hadn't, at that time, completely scrapped our usual programme of events and just done something completely different. Because there was obviously something going on, and people were shaken, and people were kind of questioning. And I just, afterwards I regretted that I hadn't sort of had the kind of courage of my convictions, or the kind of the ability just to kind of stop, drop what we were doing and do something completely different and really try and address what was going on. We tried to do it to some extent. It wasn't that we completely ignored what was going on, but I think we could have been much more bold in just taking that opportunity to kind of speak to people, to show people how the Dharma could kind of speak to what was going on. So it's kind of being alive to those possibilities and having the kind of courage to take them when they come along. We need to learn to be bold again. We're too shy of it. I think partly this is a reaction to the past, when our discourse could be a bit over-provocative, a bit harsh, a bit ideological. When I was researching my book on the history of the movement, I looked through lots and lots of old magazines, old Golden Drums and old FWO newsletters. It was really, really fascinating seeing how we used to present ourselves. One of my favourites was in an old FWO magazine, and it was an article about domesticity as the kind of enemy of the spiritual life. And the picture, which was on the cover of the magazine, was of a house, and there was this big fist holding a vajra, which was smashing through the house. Fantastic. So I sort of feel that was one extreme. But I think we've gone a bit too far to the other extreme. And maybe we could have a look at it. Yeah. So that's the fetter of superficiality. Next, the fetter of habit. So yeah, we need to be fresh and creative in our presentation of the Dharma and not over-accommodate to the ideas about Buddhism which are out there in society. But the fetter of habit. Recently we've had in the order a lot of talk about coherence and about what defines our order and movement. And this has been an important discussion and debate. As Banti said in his paper, What is the Western Buddhist Order? Every particular sangha presupposes a particular dharma. So we do need, for example, to ensure that new practices are integrated into the whole body of teaching. and that we retain a clear, coherent Dharma and a language for talking about it. And we do need to do that in order to stay united as a spiritual community. But I think we also need to ensure that what we take for coherence isn't just habit. That in our caution for coherence, we don't become rather conservative and rather stuck in a rut. And I must say, sometimes I do fear for this. I do worry that this is what will happen. For me, the debate about coherence was largely about issues in the order, which of course does impact on the movement. But my sense of the movement, there is huge coherence. There's a huge uniformity of approach to things and practices. My sense of what the movement needs is that it needs more creativity, more innovation. We need to be bolder and to take more risks. Yes, we need a coherent Dharma, but it needs to be communicated in many different ways. It's just one of those perennial tensions where you need to do seemingly opposite things both at the same time to retain coherence, but also to be innovative and creative and do things in different ways. So yes, there's habit. It's sometimes described as the gravitational pull, just this tendency to settle into certain ways of doing things. And I think the reason we settle into doing them that way is because they work. Something works, so you carry on doing it, and it carries on working. But after a while, it might stop working, or it might not be working so well, or it might not be working for certain people. But because you've been doing it for so long, you've kind of got into a habit, and you don't notice that it's not working quite so well, or that it's not attracting certain kinds of people. But it's kind of become a bit of a habit. So I think an obvious example of this recently, which has been started to be talked about, is the whole area of attracting young people to the Dharma. It's become quite clear that there's hardly anybody in their 20s in the order. Most people in the order now are in their 40s and 50s or older. And it's really good that we've started talking about this and doing something about this, because it is actually very important and very serious. I think that if we don't start attracting more young people, in about 20 years' time, we will start going into decline. In about 20 years' time, all the older members that are kind of currently running things will be too old to do that. There'll be much fewer older members around who are younger and still able to run things, and things will get more and more stretched, and the inevitable consequence is that we just start going into decline. And, you know, once that starts to happen, there's kind of less energy available to kind of do anything about it. And so you get into a kind of a circle of decline. And I really think this is a possibility if we don't start attracting younger generations in. I think there's another reason that it's important for us. I mean, it's also important because young people need the Dharma. But there's another reason it's important for us as a movement, for the health of the movement. And that is to do with the fact that... Well, one of the strengths of our order is that there's people in it who've been ordained for 20, 30 years, 35 years. Yeah? There's been people who've experienced the life of the order for a long, long time. And so that kind of gives a kind of depth and maturity and experience. And at the moment, lots of people are being ordained in their 40s and 50s, which is fantastic. I've nothing against that. But the danger is, if we have an order that's entirely made like that, again, in 20 years' time or so, there won't be so many people with that depth of experience. Yeah? There'll be people with depth of life experience, but there won't be so many people with that depth, you know, who've been in the order for 20, 30, 40 years and so on. And I think, again, that will have a very detrimental effect on the health of the movement. So, yeah, for me it has very serious implications, and I think we have to act now, not in 20 years' time. I think if we leave it, we've been talking about this for a long time, if we carry on leaving it, it will get to a certain point where it's too late. And, yeah, we need to attract more young people. And I don't just mean a few people in their 20s coming to centres. I mean, you know, good numbers of people in their 20s seriously engaged in our Sangha and getting ordained as well. That's what I think needs to happen. And, yeah, something started to happen on this. So, as many of you know, there's been a number of weekends run for and by young people looking at what would kind of attract them. And it's been really fascinating hearing what they've had to say. Just to give you one example, quite a few of them say they're very inspired to teach. They're very inspired to go and teach meditation and Buddhism, but they're not sure that they're kind of allowed to do it. Yeah. I remember one woman who was running a university class, and she definitely felt like the older members at her local centre didn't really approve of what she was doing. Yeah. And I don't think it was that they had said anything to her. I think it was that they hadn't said anything encouraging. There was just a kind of unease about it. Yeah. And so she felt that she wasn't really encouraged to do it, which was just seemed crazy, you know, because actually she was very capable and doing a very good thing. Yeah. And I've talked to groups of order members about this more recently, and you kind of talk about this idea of getting young people to do things. And yeah, sometimes people say, well, but the trouble is we don't know what they'll be teaching. Yeah. There is a kind of, I think sometimes we can be too careful and too cautious around these things. So when that happens, I just say, well, what did Bhante do when he started the movement? You know, he just really encouraged people to take responsibility. He just got people doing things. He encouraged them to do stuff. He told them, look, you can make a difference. You can make a contribution. You can be part of something. You can go beyond yourselves. And people loved it and people responded to it. And I'm sure it was a bit chaotic and a bit messy at times, but that's how the movement came about. So yeah, we need to kind of do it responsibly and carefully, but I think we could do much, much more to encourage people, especially young people, to take responsibility and to get out there and spread the Dharma. So just my last thing on the fetter of habit, I just wanted to, when you give these kind of talks, there's a danger of oversimplifying things and presenting things in a rather one-sided thing. So I just wanted to kind of say something just to undermine my own argument. I wanted to mention, because I've been talking about the fetter of habit, I wanted to mention some new projects that have come about in our movement, just to show that actually I think what I'm saying is true, but I think we also do very well in terms of new things do arise in the movement, substantial new projects do arise. So when I was thinking about what new projects have we had over the years of our movement, I realised that, well, in starting in the 80s and then growing hugely in the 90s was Wind Horse Evolution, which Kate Raja talked about last night, and just grew into this huge opportunity for people to work together and experience Sangha, that also raised tons of money to buy lots of Buddhist centres, especially in the UK. So that was in the 80s and growing in the 90s and consolidating in the last decade. And then starting in the 90s and growing hugely in the last decade, there was Buddhafield. Yeah, so it kind of started as a way of trying to communicate and practice the Dharma in a new way, a completely kind of new innovation, as it were, that came out of the 90s. And I think in the last decade, and I suspect we'll see it grow in the next decade, was Breathworks, another completely new project, taking certain teachings and ideas from the Dharma, applying them to certain people who are kind of suffering in a particular way, and helping them with that suffering. And apparently Breathworks has got over 50 people trained now, and 150 people in training. So it's a substantial project. Yeah, it's growing into a big thing, and it has the ability to make a big difference. And also, a lot of people in Breathworks, they see themselves as a team-based right livelihood. They're trying to find ways of getting funding to run projects where they can work together as Buddhists. So when I thought about it, I thought, well, that's not bad. You know, every decade, 80s, 90s, noughties, there's been at least one big new project emerge. Yeah. So now we're in a new decade, so the question is, what's it going to be in the next 10 years? So thirdly, the fetter of doubts. When I was preparing this talk, I was looking through some notes of old talks that I'd given, and I came across the notes for a talk I gave in the late 90s at the opening of the new Birmingham Buddhist Centre. And I read these notes. I hadn't looked at them for years. And it was quite a strong experience reading them, actually. Just reading these notes of the talk, that time kind of came back to me quite strongly. Just memories of the people that I was working with and us all engaged so strongly, working so hard to try and establish this new Buddhist centre, really kind of throwing ourselves in to this project. And just kind of, yeah, we just felt at that time we would just do whatever it took to establish this new project. And all that kind of that feeling came back to me strongly. And yeah, reading those notes, it was also a strong experience of impermanence and insubstantiality, because in a way that young man who gave that talk has gone. Yeah. In another way, I could still identify with him. It was quite a strong experience of change and insubstantiality. Where was he, the young man who'd given that talk? And what struck me most about it was the tone of the talk. And yeah, partly it was a bit naive, a bit earnest, it could be a bit simplistic and sweeping in places. And it was intensely idealistic. And yeah, in some ways, an idealism not yet tempered by experience. But what really struck me was that it was also so bold. It was so confident, so forthright, so assertive. The young man who gave that talk, he really believed in what he was doing. And it really stirred me up, reading that and sort of taking in that kind of tone, that sense of confidence and forthrightness. And I found myself thinking, was it really me that gave that talk? Was it really me? And I realised that to some extent, I'd lost that confidence. I'd kind of stopped being like that in some way. Yes, I was older and more experienced and hopefully a little bit wiser. But was there also something that I'd lost sight of? So for a lot of us, getting involved in the FWBO involved that youthful idealism smacking up against the hugeness of the challenge. The difficulties, the fallouts, the complex dynamics, the burnouts, and so on. The spiritual life can be hard. The practice of Sangha can be hard. And precisely because we've come at it with such idealism, such high hopes and expectations, it can lead to disappointment and to the pain of failure. We've tried so hard, we've put ourselves in so fully, and yet we feel disappointment. And I think that's maybe a lot of what's been going on in our order in the last 10 years or so. A lot of this kind of questioning, a lot of this kind of taking stock going on. And much of it has been good and necessary. But I think there's dangers too. Sometimes I think it means we withdraw from the Sangha into a more private Dharma practice. Or we withdraw into doubt, into doubting the Sangha and each other. Or we subtly doubt ourselves and what we have to offer. We subtly lower our expectations. Or we doubt that being radical is really possible, or that the world won't change. So it comes back to this idea that breaking this fetter is about integration. In our spiritual lives, we all have to work to integrate our idealism with our lived experience. We have to kind of bring the two together. There's our idealism, and then there's what it's really been like for us in practice. And we have to kind of integrate the two. Otherwise, we fall into doubt. So this work of integration is good work. It's necessary work. Integration doesn't just come at the start of the spiritual life. It needs to be going on all the time. And I also wanted to say that youthful idealism is a necessary phase. It's really positive. I'm saying this because there was a little trend in Shabda a few years ago for poo-pooing the young hero. Please don't do that. It's a phase of energy. It's a phase of momentum, of testing oneself and learning about oneself. And it matures with experience. So encourage youthful radicalism to temper itself into mature radicalism, not into the fetter of doubt. So just to summarise so far, I'm arguing that we need to keep our teaching radical by watching out for the three fetters. Samsara drags us down. The image of Buddhism in the wider culture can beguile us, and we can over-accommodate it and fall into superficial ways of presenting the Dharma. Samsara can drag us down. Organisations have a tendency to run along familiar lines. We fall into collective habit and we don't notice it, and we don't see the opportunities we are missing. Samsara drags us down. The spiritual life is challenging. There will be failures. We won't always live up to our ideals, and we can fall into doubt. Our vision of what is possible, our confidence and our sense of conviction can become blunted. So I think it's really important that we examine this and that we have a good look at how we're presenting the Dharma. What images and words and assumptions are we using? And could we be more bold and radical? So for the last part of my talk, I want to talk about something slightly different. I've got a threefold model of radical Sangha that I just wanted to talk about a bit. Some of you, many of you, will see where I've adapted it from. But it's basically a threefold model of how people, of different ways people can work and practice in the Sangha, making it a radical Sangha, and how they can work and practice in different ways, but all contributing to this overall project of a radical Sangha. So this threefold model consists of, firstly, retreatants, what I've called retreatants, secondly, Sangha builders, and thirdly, social activists or socially engaged Buddhists. So I'm just going to say a little bit about what each of those do. So firstly, the retreatants. So these are the people who, in their lives, they step back from society. And they do this quite consciously and deliberately and creatively. They've stepped back from society in order to practice the Dharma in a particular way, in order to have as much time as possible for meditation, for study, for reflection, and so on. So in a way, living that kind of pure, undiluted Dharma life. So maybe they would be hermits, maybe forest renunciates. Maybe they would be teachers who live a lot of their lives on retreat. Maybe they'd be elders, like Bhante, just living a quiet life, reflecting. And perhaps, yeah, the role that they play is guiding and inspiring and guarding the founding principles of the order and movement. And they can also remind us of the depths. Yeah? They have that opportunity to kind of stay in touch with the depths more fully, more consistently. So they can remind us of that, either just through their example, someone being on a long retreat, or through teaching, or through friendship, and so on. So these are the retreatants, stepping back from society. Then there are Sangha builders. So these are the people who are the kind of interface between the Sangha and the surrounding society. Yeah? So they kind of meet the culture. And the way they work or live or practice is by helping or living in or working in the radical Sangha institutions of our movement. Yeah. So centres, communities, businesses and so on. And they're doing this in order to help people contact the Dharma. So they're that interface where people can kind of contact the Dharma and find out about it and really learn how to live the Dharma fully in their lives. So the Sangha builders are trying to kind of attract that percentage of people in society who may be open to, you know, becoming a Buddhist, becoming a Dharma farer, and really living a fully Dharma life. And they do that, yeah, for the sake of those people, but also for themselves, to practice Sangha, to practice friendship, communication, that kind of intensity of Sangha, selflessness, sharing, and so on. So this is the kind of Sangha builders. And yeah, we have our traditional FWO forms that's taken, and maybe there could be new forms for Sangha building as well. And then the third part of this threefold model is the social activists, or the socially engaged Buddhists. So these are the people who step out into society, deliberately step into the world because they want to help relieve the suffering of the world. So their particular emphasis is on the Dharma transforming the world and relieving the suffering of the world. And this Dharmic perspective they have may be more or less implicit or explicit. Yeah. So just to explain that a little bit more, I think within this part of the Sangha, there's a kind of spectrum of possibilities. Yeah. So at one end of the spectrum, there's those people who, yeah, they're practicing the Dharma to change the world, but the Dharma is quite implicit in what they're doing. You know, the people they're working with might not even know they're Buddhists. Yeah. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there's people who are doing this work, Dharma to change the world, and it's explicitly Buddhist. Yeah, they're talking about Buddhism in the world as a means to social transformation. So to give a kind of example of that, what that spectrum means, at this end, well, we have got lots of people. There are lots of order members who work in the world, and they do good work in the world, and their work isn't explicitly Buddhist, but it's very much inspired and part of their Dharma practice. So people might work as teachers, for example. They might be running businesses and trying to run them on ethical lines. They might be doing fundraising for charities. They might be social workers and so on. So they're in that kind of social activist wing, as it were, but the kind of Dharmic element is more implicit. Then a little bit further along the spectrum, you might have something like breathworks, who have taken certain ideas and practices from the Dharma, and they're applying to a certain situation. They're applying them to kind of relieve the suffering of certain kinds of people. So it's not fully, it's not the Dharma, it's taken from the Dharma, it's not the Dharma, but it's a bit more explicitly Dharmic, and it might be known that they're doing it as part of their Buddhist practice, as it were. Yeah. And then further down the spectrum again, you might have people who are talking to people in society explicitly in Dharma terms about how the Dharma can transform the world, about how the Dharma can help with certain situations and problems. So this is the kind of areas, this end of the spectrum that Subhuti has been particularly talking about recently, that he thinks we could have that much, much more strongly as part of our work, of our overall work. That, yeah, part of our Dharma work could be trying to talk to influential people in society, or trying to teach the Dharma to the kinds of people that we just don't meet at the moment. And maybe a lot of those people, they're not going to become full-time Buddhists in the way that we are, but there might be something about the Dharma, ethical teachings, that would really help them, that would really transform their lives. Yeah. And yes, yeah, so Subhuti's been really emphasising this side of things and saying that in a way it is missing in our current approach. I guess, of course, he's inspired by Ambedkar and by the movement in India, where it's not missing, it's there very, very strongly. And he's wanting it to come much more strongly into the movement of the West. So this is a threefold model of radical Sangha: retreatants, Sangha builders, and social activists. And of course, it's just a model. Life isn't as neat and tidy as that. Real life's never quite like that. So, for example, people might be in one strand, but actually it overlaps with another strand. So people in breathworks, in a way, they're social activists in my model, but a lot of them are trying to practice and work with other Buddhists, so they're also creating team-based right livelihoods, so they're also in the Sangha builder strand, as it were. Or you might have someone who works at a Buddhist centre in the Sangha building strand, but part of their work is going to schools, trying to find ways to communicate the Dharma in a way that's going to interest young people. Yeah. So in a way, that's more of a kind of socially engaged strand, as it were. So yeah, it's a model, and in reality, things overlap. But I found the model useful because it sort of shows how we can live and work in different ways, and yet what we do contributes to the whole. Yeah. So that's the thing about the model, that each strand on its own has its own inherent danger, has its kind of potential danger.
Yeah.
So the retreatant strand, if the other two strands weren't there, there would be the danger, the possibility, that it would just become a bit of a deva-like life. There would be a lack of the altruistic dimension. There would be an over-focus on individual practice, and that altruistic dimension wouldn't necessarily be drawn out. There'd also be a danger of possibly being drawn away from the Sangha. With the Sangha builder strand, well, maybe the potential danger here is of just getting a bit kind of stuck and habitual, a bit conservative with a small c. Because we used to talk about establishing the nucleus of a new society. Well, in a way, what happens once you've done that?
Yeah.
We've got all we've got so many kind of institutions up and running. Well, kind of what happens next? And yeah, so my sense is if we just had this strand without the other two, there's something that doesn't kind of get drawn out, and it could just get a bit stuck and established in a certain kind of way. And then the socially activist strand, maybe the potential danger here is, well, of burnout, that just practicing in the world is difficult. You know, the worldly winds blow even more strongly out there, as it were. So there's a danger of burnout, of succumbing to the worldly winds. And I suppose there's also a danger of confusion of what is the Dharma and what is other kind of ideas and ideologies. So each strand has its own inherent kind of danger, its own inherent kind of possibility of degenerating a little bit. Yeah. But if you have all three strands strong and present, they kind of balance each other out. Yeah. So what the retreatant strand offers to the other two is that it allows a place for people to go and recharge so they don't get burnt out. Yeah. It allows a place where people can kind of go and reconnect with the depths. And for those people in the retreatant strand, it then gives them a kind of altruistic dimension to their practice. That's what they can offer in an altruistic way to the others in the Sangha. The Sangha builders provide the base, a positive supportive conditions for the social activists. So maybe the social activists might live in a community or come to a centre and so on. Yeah? And the Sangha builders provide a way of people getting a deeper connection with the Dharma. So maybe the social activists will meet certain people. Some of them will want a deeper connection with the Dharma. And the Sangha builders are building a kind of way for that to happen. So again, they're kind of balancing each other out and supporting each other. And then thirdly, the social activists, well, they're providing a contact with the wider society and with different kinds of people. So probably that could have a kind of galvanizing effect on the Sangha builders and retreatants, on the rest of the Sangha. Yeah. They're very much kind of providing that altruistic dimension of us not just settling into a kind of cozy niche where we're attracting and working with certain kinds of people, but we're always trying to kind of go beyond ourselves, as it were. And yeah, as Lokeshwara mentioned last night, Subhuti's been talking about, well, maybe it's by doing this kind of work that the Sangha building element of our Sangha can be really kind of galvanised and rejuvenated, because it just kind of gives a sense of common project and energy. So yeah, this is my threefold model of radical Sangha: retreatants, Sangha builders and social activists. And they all make their contribution, and that contribution is part of the whole. Yeah. And if any one of those strands was missing, there would be a real lack. There would be something, yeah, important, really missing. So that's basically my talk. Just got a couple of points to conclude with, if that's okay. Just 2 points to conclude with. On this, so as Lokeshwara mentioned, some of us were on a seminar at Dharmapala College recently, talking about the new society. There was 20 or so order members and mitras on the seminar, and lots of good talks, and people got really inspired by these ideas of taking the Dharma out and so on. But of course, a common question was, well, how do we do this? can we do this? So quite a strong part of my experience of the seminar was a sense of inspiration and a sense of, oh, but can we do this? How do we do this, as it were? And I was reminded of another story that I heard from Naga Bodhi. He told years ago when I was on a retreat some time. And it was a story of when he was the editor of Golden Drum magazine. And he was the editor, and he was a bit frustrated at the time because he would get people to write articles, and he felt what they wrote was always a bit boring, a bit kind of bland and boring. And he was particularly frustrated by this because he knew that they were talented people. He knew that they were quite capable people. They'd had quite responsible jobs in the past. They were creative and intelligent. And yet when he got them to write about Buddhism or Dharma, it was just a bit kind of glib and dull what they wrote. So he was talking to Bhante one day, and he just happened to mention this. And apparently what Bhante said was, well, yes, they've given up their mundane talents, but they haven't yet found the genius of their individuality. Yeah. I found that quite a moving answer. Yeah, they've left behind their mundane talents, but they haven't yet found the genius of their individuality. And I think that's what it's like for us sometimes. I think that's what the spiritual life is like. We've left something behind that we know we don't want anymore, and yet we haven't found our voice. We haven't yet found the genius of our individuality. And it's quite a painful place to be. It's quite frustrating. But we just have to keep going. And eventually we will find the genius of our individuality. And I think we are starting to do it more and more. Last thing I wanted to say was sparked off by Ketaraja's talk. I was very fascinated by him talking about the collective myths that inspired and shaped the different phases of the history of Windhorse evolution. So he talked about in the early days there was this collective myth of the heroic ideal. Yeah. So this was the era of establishing the business, this idealistic struggle to kind of get something going, and the collective myth of the heroic ideal. And then a bit later, there was an era of huge growth and expansion. And then the collective myth became the myth of building the Buddha land. And then he said in the last decade, well, the myth was almost that there wasn't a collective myth anymore. There was a phase of questioning, of taking stock, of people looking at their own experience and their own needs, and a bit of a move away from the collective. And maybe that was a necessary corrective, a rebalancing from what had gone before. And then he talked about the next phase that he hoped they were moving into, and said that they did need a collective myth again if they were going to survive. And it needed to be a myth that allowed for individual needs, individual temperaments, but also that drew people beyond themselves into selflessness. And Ketaraja also reflected that often what happens at Windhorse evolution is a kind of microcosm version of what's been going on in the wider movement. And that really struck a chord with me, and I very much identified with those phases and those collective myths that he talked about. And I also kind of identified with a sense that the movement is moving into a new phase as well. I think there are signs of that. So it left me wondering, what could the myth of the order and the movement be in a new phase? Is there a myth that holds both the individual and the collective? Maybe there's an obvious possibility. It's not a new myth, but it's an old one, first given to us by Bhante, but perhaps now we can understand it more deeply. It is, of course, the myth of the 1,000 armed Avalokiteshvara. The way the story goes is that Avalokiteshvara wanted so much to relieve the suffering of the world, but the task was so great, the challenges were so many, that he became overwhelmed. And he fell into doubt. He no longer felt it possible he could do anything for the world. Maybe it was best just to be happy and peaceful himself. But because of the power of his previous vows, his head cracked into 11 pieces, and his body broke into 1,000 parts. And he cried out in agony to the Buddha Amitabha and was transformed into the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. We've been through our phase of doubt, perhaps in some ways good and necessary. But my dream is that because of the power of our previous vows, we too are transformed more deeply. That we have 1,000 arms and more than 1,000 arms reaching out into the world in all directions. And that these arms are connected to the same spiritual heart, all nourished by the same spiritual body. And each hand holds its own particular implement, reaches out in its own individual way. But at the same time, they work together. May the order be inspired by the myth of Avalokiteshvara, but on a deeper, more mature, more integrated level than ever before, allowing for the individual and the collective. May we aspire, as Bhante has said, to be the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, with hands reaching out, offering the Dharma as medicine for this suffering world.